Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're concerned about mental health or looking to get into self-improvement, join me at the Piece by Piece podcast. There, I'm interviewing everyday people and experts alike about how to overcome difficulties around mental health. Speaking of which, I just released an interview with a mental health historian and another with two friends who are healthcare workers.
If these conversations interest you, check us out at Piece by Piece. That's Piece with an A, B-I, and then Piece with an I. Thank you so much.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
I'm Sheila Shoiga, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. In this episode, I speak to Professor Ian Robertson about confidence.
And the fourth way that confidence works is it makes you smarter. Because this dopamine activity in your reward network spreads out into the frontal lobes of your brain, and that neurotransmitter, it helps them function better. And so you can think more clearly. You can respond quicker. You can see the wood for the trees. So it's a bit of a magic, if you can get it, it's a bit of a magic recipe, really, to learn to be confident in an area.
Ian is a clinical psychologist, a neuroscientist, and he's widely recognised as one of the world's leading researchers in neuropsychology. And he's also the author of several best-selling books, including How Confidence Works. In this conversation, he tells us what confidence is, what makes someone confident, the differences between men and women in terms of confidence and why that is, the art of bullshitting, and the power of positive self-talk. Here it is.
Okay, confidence. Some of us have it, some of us don't, some of us want to have it. So let's learn about it. Yeah. What exactly is it?
Well, let me say what it's not, first of all. So it's not optimism.
Okay.
Optimism is the belief that things will turn out. And it's not self-esteem. Self-esteem is your belief that your evaluation of yourself, okay, how well you think of yourself. Confidence, its secret sauce, is it's linked to action. Confidence is the belief that you can do a particular thing, and also your belief that if you do that thing, then the good outcome you want will happen. So confidence is an action enabler.
Okay.
It works in the brain. If you want me to?
Yeah. No, I love this. Please go on. Yeah.
So. Confidence, our brains work as prediction machines, okay? And one of the things we predict is the outcome of our own actions. And if you predict that you can successfully do that action or take that step, say that difficult thing in that difficult conversation, if you say, I can do this to yourself, I've had the feeling you can do it, your brain chalks that up as a success. Already, confidence is linked to a specific domain. So I can be generally optimistic about the world, but I can't be generally confident about myself. I can be confident I can be confident in certain domains. I can be confident that I can speak approximate sense to you in a podcast or when I'm giving a lecture.
Yeah.
But not confident that I can entertain you socially at a party, that I can, my small talk, I'm maybe not that confident about my ability to make small talk.
Okay, I get you.
Or my ability to be funny, or my ability to do woodwork, or my ability, ability to I don't know.
Be a ballet dancer.
Yes, or play tennis. You know, I can be as confident as I like about tennis. Yeah, I'm still a dreadful tennis
right,
player.
Right, yeah.
So confidence is linked to action, and essentially, you know, you build confidence by successfully doing these actions.
So is it fake it till you make it?
Well, there's a bit of, you see, that's the thing about confidence is it's something that's to a considerable extent learnable.
Yeah. And so it is, that's the whole, are you born with it or is it something you develop over time? Yeah. It's something you develop.
It's something you develop. There are maybe certain, you may have certain advantages that you're born with, a certain particular personality, for instance, that makes it easier for you to be confident. But that doesn't mean to say if you have a very shy personality that you cannot learn to be confident. You can.
Yeah.
And fake it till you make it. There's a huge truth to that because most people, when they do something for the first time, can't be certain that they will manage it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
The first time, I remember the first time I gave a lecture at a big international conference. I mean, I was absolutely terrified.
Yeah,
and
of course.
Wasn't that confident. Now I can do that without too much bother, you know, because
you've done it before.
I've done it
before.
And I can
do this.
But yeah. So how does confidence work in the brain? So it's an incredible thing because what it does is it because your brain says, oh, I can do this, or, you know, it takes it up as a success. Mm. That gives you your brain a little spurt of an incredibly powerful neurotransmitter, dopamine. You've heard of dopamine.
Yeah.
That's a natural antidepressant, that activity. So it lifts your mood. Simultaneously, it reduces your anxiety. So it's a natural anti-anxiety drug. Then it increases your motivation and makes you more likely to do the thing. And you're more likely then, therefore, to get the success experience because you do it. An awful lot of anxious people who don't feel confident, they step back, they don't take the action. Anxious people across the world do less stuff in general. And because they do less stuff, they get less opportunities for reinforcement, for reward.
Yeah,
and that deprives their brain of these multiple mini antidepressant, mood elevating, anti-anxiety shots that they get.
Okay.
And the fourth way that confidence works is it makes you smarter. Because this dopamine activity in your reward network spreads out into the frontal lobes of your brain, and that neurotransmitter, it helps them function better.
Oh.
And so you can think more clearly. You can respond quicker. You can see the wood for the trees.
Mm.
So it's a bit of a magic, if you can get it, it's a bit of a magic recipe, really, to learn to be confident in an area.
Yeah, I'm thinking of a few things now, right? I'm thinking of the fact that as Irish people, I wouldn't say that the word confident goes hand in hand with the Irish psyche. We seem to be quite self-deprecating as a people. And there's a whole, like, you know, if you're confident, it's your notions, you know, getting above your station, being a bit cocky, being a bit this. There's a kind of confusion around what it actually is, because there's obviously a big difference between being confident and then being overly confident. But it sounds like breaking through your comfort zone, pushing yourself outside that, as often as you can, is a really good thing to build that sense of, I can do this, therefore I am confident.
Precisely. And two things there. Marissa Mayer, who was the first big tech company CEO of Yahoo, she said this about success, but it applies to confidence as well. She said, success is about doing things before you feel quite ready. And the second thing is, you're talking about the Irish, and it's also a Scottish thing of self-deprecation, of, you know, you don't want to to stand out. You don't want to be seen to be arrogant or swaggering and say, oh, this is probably rubbish that I'm going to say to you. Oh, don't listen to me. Oh, I'm such a mess. Or I'm sorry. You say sorry before you've done anything.
Yeah.
It's a weird kind of...
Absolutely.
And that's fine. That's just a verbal tick, the sorry business. But the self-deprecation, you know, saying you're in a meeting or about and you say, you do this preemptive strike. You say, this is probably rubbish what I'm going to say, but... Now, what that does in the short term, it makes you feel less anxious.
Okay.
It's a kind of, don't criticise me.
So it's kind of protection thing.
It's a self-protection thing. You know, don't criticise me, you know.
Because you're getting in there first. You're putting yourself down first.
Exactly. But what that does is it sabotages your own confidence in the thing you're about to say. But also, even more importantly, it sabotages other people's view of you. And of course, that's mutually interactive. So that's why Marissa Mayer was right. You know, you just say it and you bite your tongue with these little self-deprecating habits. Now, of course, some people don't like that because then the risk is you then, particularly for women compared to men, the risk is you start to come to be seen to be, you know, up yourself, you know, or kind of, you know, arrogant or, you know.
Well, there is that double standard, isn't there, for men and women, particularly when it comes to the workplace. Like, you know, the man who stands up for himself, he can be seen as strong and assertive and alpha and he's a boss and he's a leader. But she's a bitch.
It's a huge trap for women. It's a huge, huge trap for women.
Yeah.
The behaviours that are acceptable in men and women get punished for them.
Mm.
Now, fortunately... The days of the kind of swaggering alpha male boss throwing his weight about, you know, are in many countries are somewhat numbered, or at least it's much harder for them to behave in that way because of all sorts of corrective systems there are. And the scope there is for the kind of the kind of leadership that involves the kind of quiet confidence and the quiet team building and the kind of us rather than me.
Mm.
There's more scope for that in the world now.
Which is a real positive.
Which is a real positive.
Yeah.
And in that kind of world, the kind of the swaggering charisma of, you know, the can-do kind of John Wayne leader, that kind of doesn't cut the mustard anymore, particularly in complex tech companies and media companies. You can't, you know, you have to, people have to work as a team. And, you know, the more you have this, the more you have very hierarchical structures like that kind of behavior tends to produce, the less intelligent the team becomes.
Right.
Because team IQ is not correlated with individual IQ. So you can have a team of several people trying to solve problems. And that, if that team, the ability of that team, the smarts of that team to be able to solve the problems isn't correlated with the individual IQs of that team. It's correlated with the team IQ. And there's three things that define the team IQ. One of these is the equal proportion of time spent speaking by the team members. So if you have a big, swaggering, dominant team leader who spends all the time talking, or most of the time talking, that squishes the team IQ, okay? Because you're not networking the brains of the team together sufficiently. The second thing is the average ability of the team members to read other people's emotional expressions, because you can't network brains together unless people can kind of suss out whether you're bored or interested or angry or annoyed or sad. And the third thing is the proportion of women in the team. So more balanced teams, gender-wise, are smarter teams.
Okay.
But that's entirely accounted for by the fact that women have higher average ability to read other people's emotional expressions.
Mm.
So if you want a smart team, the last thing you want is the very dominant, overconfident, swaggering, kind of classic, kind of male dominant figure.
Yeah.
That just destroys the IQ of otherwise very smart teams. And that's why the kind of quiet leadership that may not be, you know, you're overconfident of women is more at a premium these days. And men, of course, and men can behave like that. Many men do behave like that.
Yeah. Before I kind of go back to the male-female thing, because that's really, really interesting, Just what you were saying there, and you were giving the example of somebody in the meeting who starts off putting themselves down, being self-deprecating, and the damage that does. Is it because, again, back to what you were saying about, you know, the mind is listening, I suppose, the unconscious part of our brain is absorbing whatever we feed it?
Yeah, absolutely. Most of what determines our behaviour is, there's so much going on in our brain, and we've only got a tiny percentage of that we can be consciously aware of. So if you say, "Oh, what I'm saying is probably rubbish," these words actually embed themselves at some level into your into your unconscious processing, and it becomes a kind of habit of thinking and of experiencing. So that's why, going back to your fake it till you make it, it is the case that if you're going to meet the big boss, there's a primitive tendency to make yourself small.
Okay, yeah.
You know, this. Mm. If you fake it in the sense of just stand proud and tall, not a big swagger, but you just stand proud and tall, even though inside you may be resisting that, that's just an example of a very simple kind of faking it that will actually trick your brain to think something like, if you're standing tall, that signifies self-belief.
Yeah, yeah.
And similarly, if you say, look, I think that we should do X, and you don't say, oh, I don't know if this is rubbish, but if you bite your tongue and don't say the first bit and just say, I think, and then this is what I believe, I think it's right.
Bonus.
I know nothing is certain.
Mm.
It's always uncertainty in anything we decide to do, but I am choosing to believe in myself saying that in spite of the anxiety.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's the great thing about confidence, is one of the great ways of building it is doing things in spite of feeling anxious.
Yeah. So it's almost recognize that feeling, accept that it's there and you don't, but still.
Precisely.
Do the thing. That's
one of the great things is people being frightened of fear, anxious about anxiety, and that multiplies.
Mm.
Mara Wilson, the child actress, Mrs. Doubtfire, she said years later, she said, I wish someone had told me it was okay to be anxious.
Oh.
And it is okay to be anxious.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people just not accepting it as a normal emotion that actually is actually a form of energy. Because that anxiety has the same symptoms as excitement. And all it is your body preparing for action.
Yeah, so stress and excitement, very much the same.
Yeah, well, stress is the perception. Stress is the perception that what's being asked of you exceeds your ability to cope with it. And anxiety is the resulting emotion.
Say that again, sorry.
So stress is a perception.
Yeah.
That what's being asked of you, the demands made on you, exceed your ability to cope with them.
Right.
So it's a perception.
Okay.
And because you feel
I can't do
control,
this. Yeah.
You feel anxious.
All right, yeah.
So it follows from that. If you change the perception, you can change the stress from being a source of retreat and anxiety to one of excitement and challenge.
So that's where your self-talk, what you say to yourself, is so important.
It's so important. And also, exactly, so the words you say to yourself are incredibly important.
Yeah.
The posture you adopt is incredibly important.
Yeah.
The eye contact you make.
I'm sitting up straighter now because I have a tendency to slouch.
Well, so do I, but yeah.
It's you know, you mentioned being quietly confident, and straight away I am much more comfortable with that rather than if somebody said, he's confident or he's quietly confident, I'd instantly smile and feel more connected to the quietly confident person, be it male or female. And I suppose because one of the qualities I admire most in people is humility.
Yeah.
And somebody who is... it has that confidence, but, you know, it's not showy about it.
Yeah.
So is there a way of harnessing all the power of confidence, but, you know, not being so outwardly about it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean...
and that's probably where we want to get to, is it?
Yeah. The thing about what you're really talking about there is a kind of a brash overconfidence.
Yeah. Am I just confused?
No.
Perhaps I am. Am I not?
No, you're not confused.
All right, okay.
No, because you see, confidence is a two-edged sword.
Okay.
Too much of it leads to overconfidence.
Okay, yeah.
Too little. Many of the brain's processes are like that. Too much and too little, you underperform. We're all slightly overconfident compared to brute reality. We would not have a gambling industry without that.
Okay.
You know, people who buy a lottery ticket exaggerate in their own mind the chances that this action will produce a winning. People who bet on horses, there's a kind of chronic over-optimism and overconfidence, which gets us up in the morning, gets us running our own businesses, doing our own podcasts, things like that. So, so it's a healthy, but it's a healthy kind of overestimation of our chances, say, of our business succeeding, because most businesses don't succeed. But when it becomes too much, it becomes excessive. You get people become blind to risk. They become arrogant. They start treating other people as objects. They become narcissistic. Mm-hmm. And the thing about so many of our actions in the world are about our relationships with other people, as opposed to, for example, our ability to build a computer or to fix a lawnmower. Okay. Their confidence is critically important to help you persist through failures, to persist through difficulties, to learn how to fix a computer, for instance. Mm. In social relationships with other people, so much of it is about persuading other people. It's about persuasion, influencing other people. Mm. Okay. And there, we're in the much more in the domain where the kind of superficialities of swaggering salesmanship, which we call overconfidence. Mm. You know, the person who comes in and, you know, the classic one, the cliche about women having the jobs advertised has five characteristics. The woman has three of them, doesn't apply. The man has two, applies, and he gets the job.
Yeah.
That's part of the kind of the salesmanship, because confidence makes you a better salesperson. And because of that, it buys you status. Mm. And that status sticks even if the fact that you're unjustifiably overconfident is revealed to the group. In other words, overconfidence is just such an unfair way of buying influence in people, particularly people who feel underconfident. That's part of the politics of populist politics of the world today. Selling people and, you know, persuading by virtue of this, selling people simple messages, overconfident that I can do X, Y, and Z. And it's not what the world needs. The world needs the quiet confidence of the scientists, patiently delivering, persisting. The woman that came up with the mRNA for the COVID vaccine, she, Turkish woman, worked for years against huge adversity in Germany, lost her job several times, persisted with the idea, and eventually came through. I mean, there was no swaggering charisma, but without her confidence in her ability to follow through this idea, she would never have got it.
Yes.
So that's the critical thing. And we have, so you're not confused at all about confidence, because in the social domain, it's very, very unfortunately easy for people to get a status by virtue of their ability to have the external trappings of confidence and give people a false impression of what they know and what they can do. And women suffer vis-a-vis men on this hugely, because men are much better able to do it.
Well, let's talk about that, because I know you did studies with children as well in this area, just to see the vast difference between boys and girls. And I suppose as a mother of two kids, I have a boy and a girl. You know, he's, my little boy's five, my baby girl's not even one. But it's something that, you know, when I read it, it did instantly make me feel sad and frustrated, and how there is such a massive need for change in society, and how we speak to our kids and what we teach them and what they're absorbing from the environment.
Yeah.
So anyway, let's talk about that, because it's really interesting.
Yeah. So, well, let me start with the good news, which is this is not fixed. This is not a biological, unfixable reality. This confidence gap between men and women, boys and girls, it's as a result of systematic social psychological processes. Mm. And if you go to a country like America, the gap between men and women is much less than it is in a country like Ireland or Scotland or the UK, where the, and that's true also for socioeconomic status. The if you're a working class woman in Ireland or Scotland, the huge deficit you have in confidence.
Mm.
So
globally, are Ireland, Scotland kind of,
in the OECD countries, we're way down the bottom.
Are we?
I can tell you how we measure this if you want.
Please, yeah.
So, if I may use the term, the bullshit index.
Okay.
So bullshitting
love
means
this. bullshit index.
Bullshitting means thinking or pretending you know things that you don't. So in the PISA study of educational attainment across the OECD countries, they very cleverly put in a series of questions about how well do you know these mathematical concepts, you know, differential, you know, equation.
Right.
Zero, not at all, 10, know it and understand it fully.
Yeah.
So they give a list of maybe a dozen of these, but three of them don't exist.
Brilliant.
And so you get a measure across countries.
Yeah, so people are caught out then,
they're
obviously.
Caught out. They say, yes, spirelectomy equations I've heard of, fully understand them.
they don't even exist.
They don't exist.
Right.
Now, you look at boys versus girls. Of course, boys bullshit more than girls.
Yeah.
You look at...
But why do they?
Because bullshitting buys you status.
Okay. And that's ingrained from an early age in boys.
Well, we're a group species, and we exist in hierarchical groups. We form dominance hierarchies, and where we are in the dominance hierarchy has huge implications for all sorts of things, from whether we find a mate to whether we get the best food and best shelter.
You're after reminding me of something. I remember a number of years ago, very quickly, I went into a card shop to buy a card for a friend's kid, a girl, and all the boy cards were, you're awesome, you can do this, superheroes, and all the affirmations on them were very empowering and go get them and you're strong.
Yeah.
And all the girls were, again, it's back to that, it's the princess mentality.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, it's almost a bit subservient or submissive.
Yeah.
And it's all based on the appearance and lovely and pretty and kind and love. But nothing about strength.
No,
go and get them,
no,
or any of that. So straight away, it was so blatantly obvious when I looked at the cards, and I got a bit annoyed. I got a bit annoyed about it because I was kind of struggling to get the card for. Whereas if my friend's kid was a boy, there were a ton of cards I could have picked up, and any one of them was brilliant. But they were all kind of doing the same thing for girls, and they were all just their messaging for me. And now as a mother of a girl, I'm like, this is not good enough.
No,
not good enough.
There's a huge headwind. Huge headwind for girls and women. And that's a very good example of that headwind.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
But the interesting thing, so you get huge differences in bullshitting. Now, let's just say bullshitting's not necessarily a bad thing, actually.
We've all done it. Let's be honest. I've done it.
I know. Of course we have. But the kids who maybe even thought they knew, but who said they knew these and understand these non-existent concepts, they also were more likely to report that they would persist through problems. They were more likely to persist through difficulties in school.
Okay.
They were more likely. So there was all sorts of motivational and grit features that were associated with this tendency to bullshit.
Yeah. So because straight away you would think when you say it, you would almost associate it with it with the negative. And even though, okay, we all want to teach our kids and ourselves, you know, be honest.
Yeah.
But we all, whether we want to admit it or not, even the most straight up honest, straight as die person, we tell little white lies. They happen in daily life.
Yeah.
You know, it does. It's, I suppose it's the reality, isn't it? But it's actually not a bad thing. It's not necessarily.
Not necessarily in moderation. So it's as much
as long as you're not a compulsive liar.
Yeah, exactly. So not a psychopath. But
yeah.
It's not an it's a kind of aspiration. But the interesting thing was, you can look at these differences between men and women across countries.
Yeah.
And in America, the difference in bullshitting between men and women is relatively small. So what that means is that women in America don't have the same confidence penalty that women, and the bottom of the lot was Scotland. You know, Scottish women did not bullshit at all. And Scottish men did much lower than Americans.
Which in a way is admirable, because what you see is what you get then.
Well, except if it becomes self-sabotaging and self-deprecating,
and pulls them down in life.
Yeah, so it's not the fact. Yes, it's better that they honestly said, "I didn't know spirolectomy equations."
Yeah, I getcha.
But it's all the other things. These women would be more likely to give up when they didn't manage to do the sum for their homework. They're more likely to give up and say, "Oh, I'm no good at that."
Yeah.
Whereas the equivalent American person would be more likely to keep trying. If you like, so this sort of, you know, this confidence thing, there's a wee bit of play acting about it, you know, fake it till you make it. There's a wee bit of, you know what, I can't be certain I can do this, but you know what, I think I can do it. And even just saying the words to yourself, rehearsing the words, has a number of positive effects. If we have time later, I can tell you a story about Porrick Harrington.
No, tell it now. I'd love to hear it,
So Porrick Harrington was, this 2007, I think, Open in Carnoustie, the British Open, big prize in golf. And he was in the lead ahead of Sergio Garcia at the 17th hole. And he said he was just in the zone playing beautifully. And he said, He really already was imagining himself getting the claret jug and winning the Open, huge prize. And he said, he was teeing off at the 17th, he said, something happened in my mind, I just don't know what it was. And he hit the ball and it went into the Barry Burn, into the river. And he said, no, I didn't feel too badly about that. You know, I was okay. And, you know, he walked up, took the penalty shot, hit it again, back into the river, twice into the river. And he describes the feeling of, first of all, this image of him winning the Open, collapsing in ruins, but also the sense of humiliation and embarrassment at doing something so ludicrous in front of millions of people watching on television. Mm. So he was a complete mess. Walking up the fairway with his caddy, Ronan Flood, just said this one thing to him over and over again. He just said, you are the best chipper and putter in the world. You are the best chipper and putter in the world. Over and over again. Until Harrington said, if I'd been holding my club, I would have hit him with it, you know. But by the time they got to take the second penalty shot, he chipped it beautifully.
Yeah.
Putted and holed it. Even past Sergio Garcia, who gave him a big run, big grin, because he thought he was going to win. Squared the 18th hole, played well in the 18th hole, evened the match. There was a playoff and he won it. Huge celebrations.
Mm.
It's not the end of the story, because Flood and his caddy and him didn't see each other all evening. And they were into the limo to go back to the hotel later. And Harrington turned to Flood and said, you know, Ronan, you saved my bacon out there. After I hit that second shot into the river, I didn't think it had a chance. And he saw that Flood was laughing. He said, why are you laughing? He said, I didn't think you had a chance either. So Flood was just saying the words.
Yeah.
But he was saying the words in such a way, he essentially hacked into Harrington's brain.
Yes.
So that by the time Harrington came to take that second shot, there was nothing, because our conscious awareness is a very limited capacity system. We can only have so much in our mind at any one time.
Mm.
And so all that was in his mind by the time Flood finished with him was something, was a set of behaviours that he was the best in the world, that he had rehearsed. So his memory system was now only supplying him with past successes in chipping and putting.
Yeah.
And his attention system was narrowed in with no room to think about great success or great failure, great admiration or great humiliation. The big thoughts were gone because all there was in his mind was chipping and putting. So that meant that when he came to chip that shot, his brain was in a sweet spot because there weren't the big surges of elation or anxiety that disturbed the networks of the brain you need for elite sport. All there was his attention.
Completely focused.
And that was done partly through the artificial means of the words you say to yourself, he said to himself.
See, I really do connect with this in a big way because I suppose I learned, I've been a fan of affirmations because my self-talk can often, the inner critic can often be turned up quite loud in my own head. I'm really working on it, I have been for years, to turn it down. So I really do believe in the idea of how you speak to yourself. And I have friends who catch me when I say things, stop, what, you're saying that again. And then, you know, you realise yourself and you catch yourself saying certain things. Or I find when I'm speaking to my kids, I notice how I'm speaking and I have to be aware of it. But I noticed that when I was pregnant with my son, I wanted to have a natural birth experience. And a lot of people told me I was for the birds. You know, you're going to scream, you're going to want the epidural, you're going to want all the drugs known to man. But I really knew I was afraid and knew it was an unknown territory. But I really did want to give it my best. So I decided to really work on affirmations. So I had post-its, coloured post-its all over the house. I had them, you know, by my bed and the everywhere, in the kitchen, everywhere. Like it was, the house looked a little bit, if you came to visit, you might have thought I had mental health issues. But the day came that I, you know, my waters broke and I started to have contractions. And fast forward number of hours, I have my baby boy in my arms and I have given birth to him without any drugs. And I had, very fortunately, had a very beautiful birth experience that made me feel like a superwoman, to be honest.
Yeah,
And I fundamentally believe it was because I fed my mind for months, for a number of months, not even that long, but for a number of months before I gave birth, I was telling myself, I can do this. And the proof's in the pudding, it worked.
Well, that's a good, I mean, it's a great story. And you know, affirmations work if they're tied to quite specific behaviours.
Yeah, and it was an ultimate goal. You know, I don't think there's anything more profound or primal than giving birth.
Exactly, yeah. So if you know, affirmations that say, oh, I am wonderful, or you know, I'm, you know, generalised affirmations are not particularly useful for most people, whereas very specific ones like you're talking about, because they're linked to actions, you are indeed, you're priming yourself. And you're giving yourself a sense of control.
So like with Porrick, it was the chipping and the putting, and it was a very focused
and
goal.
Because he was thinking about nothing else, not only was he not anxious, but he was actually going to perform better because his brain was in a state of focus. And similarly, your words that you were putting, your affirmations were, they were focusing your attention. If you can, to the degree that you can control your attention, you can control pain, you can control distress, you can control emotions.
So that's confidence?
Well, confidence is a belief that you can do something. So if I believe I can do something, that will focus my attention.
Yeah.
So that's why taking action is so a critical part of confidence. There's two kind of modes of thinking, broadly speaking, deliberation and implementing. Deliberation is, what am I going to do? You know, what am I going to do X, Y, and Z? And there your attention opens wide and you're thinking through, should I move house? Should I change relationship? And the swings of ups and downs, and your attention, and you're much more likely to experience anxiety because your attention is very wide. But then there's implementation. I've decided to move house. I've decided to enter that relationship. I've decided to start that course.
Yeah.
And there you're focused on a specific goal, which is in the future, and with that belief that you can achieve at least intermediate stages towards that goal. That's the most incredible. That's like a shield against anxiety and self-doubt. Unlike the deliberation mode, you're in implementation mode, so you're in action mode. That's the best possible kind of mind-altering drug you can have.
Yeah.
So confidence makes it more likely for you to get into that mode, and being in that mode makes it more likely you will experience the confidence that comes from successfully accomplished actions.
Yeah. It's funny that, and I know this conversation is not about me, but very quickly, when I was pregnant then with my baby girl, I thought I would feel very confident going into, I got to do this all again.
Yeah.
You know, human out of my body thing.
Yeah.
And I was quite scared because I felt like I hadn't done half as much preparation as I had on my son. I didn't do the post-its this time around. But in saying that, when it came to the day, my body had already done the work before, so there was a certain amount of muscle memory. And fortunately, I had a lovely birth experience without drugs the second time also.
Yeah.
But I was more fearful, interestingly, simply because I suppose it's the classic failed, prepare to fail.
Well, that's right. I mean, you put a lot of work into the first
time. I had, and I hadn't the second time.
Yeah, but the fact is that confidence, the biggest source of confidence is completed.
Yeah, successfully I did this before. Yeah. Before. And as you said, with the speaking, you know, the first time you did it, you were quite nervy, and now it doesn't really take a feather out of you.
Yeah.
How has your own confidence improved with your study of it?
Well, it's very interesting because I was brought up a working class boy, council house in Glasgow, and you know, there's a number of things that sap your confidence. Your socioeconomic status is it's probably not quite as undermining as your gender, in terms of potentially undermining your confidence, or your physical appearance, or your race, or your age. All of these things, all of them have stereotypes associated with them. To the extent that you internalize the stereotype, it undermines your confidence. So I was not a confident young person. And, you know, I remember the first time when I moved into academia, my first talk to an international conference, I was a complete jelly. And that's interesting, because when you're in a state of anxiety like that, your mind selectively pays attention to evidence of failure. So you look at the person frowning in the audience or the person shaking their head and nod to the majority of people who are looking interested, and your memory systems go back to throw up past failures, and that multiplies it. So to the extent that I know now, if I see someone frowning in a talk I'm giving or shaking their head, I know my attention will lock onto that, but I know consciously to pull it away and to focus on the people who are looking interested.
Yes.
So that's one of the little mental habits that make it easier for me to have a reasonable success experience after giving a lecture or something.
Mm.
That means that I will then be more confident about the next one. But
we do lock on to the negative, don't we?
Of course.
Again, the advice there is to, you know, you're going to recognize it, but try and move away from it.
Yes, realize that not allow yourself to be sucked into low probability events of, you know, that's not a good source of data about whether you did well or not. Okay.
Yeah.
And you can consciously, you know, take yourself out of the anxiety state and say, well, look, how do I think I actually did there? How would a dispassionate observer think I did? And if you get out of the tunnel of your own head, then you can say, actually, I did not badly. So you can almost rewrite some experiences as, you know, that you were seeing as a failure, as a success. So you can do a bit of rewriting. But it's all of these things are habits of thinking that we've had over tens of years. And habits take a long, long time to unravel, you know, to overcome. So you have to be patient about this and realize, no, you can't just say to yourself, oh, because, you know, if I pay attention to the good things, I won't think these thoughts. No, you have to work at gradually overwriting these self-deprecating thoughts with more confidence-enhancing ones.
Can you talk about the exercise that was carried out with the boys and girls again and what came out of that? Because it was really interesting how different the results were.
Yes. So there was one, this was the, there's a couple of studies, but there was one, the BT Young Scientist exhibition in Dublin, which I'm a judge on, and two young lads from down in Cork, fantastic young guys, they were wondering why young girls didn't go into STEM subjects, science, technology subjects, and so they just gave them, these five-year-olds, piece of paper and said, draw me a doctor, draw me an engineer, and they gave that to the boys as well, and the girls, and give them a name so you know what sex it is. The girls, 50% of the time the engineer was female, 50% they were male. The boys, 95% it was a male engineer. So even at that age, you were getting this. You realised that the girls' perception about what they could and could not do was actually shaped. The boys were the saboteurs, unconscious saboteurs.
Yeah. And what age are we talking?
Five.
God, the same age as my kid now.
Yeah. So, but, you know, the good news is, as we see from, you know, America's way ahead in terms of sex equality and what women are regarded as being capable of. I mean, we had the NASA launches, you know, women engineers running them, you know.
And
you just have to work at it. And that shows you that this is not biologically determined. This is not fate. This is how we bring up our children and what we believe and what we say to ourselves.
Yeah, and I suppose as individuals, if like whether we're parents or not, most of us interact with kids in one way or another. Yeah. Be aware how we speak to them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And what we're feeding them.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, I suppose the most important thing is to empower both boys and girls. But certainly that girls are as able and capable. And get that message across to the boys.
Yeah,
the girls are as capable as them.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then something, anyway.
Okay. Just you know how women are supposed to be worse than men at visuospatial abilities? That's a prejudice that exists. Stereotype.
Yeah.
So and then,
but is it based on like genetic kind of programming or how we're biologically programmed?
Let me make the argument not that it's not.
Okay, so good.
Mary Mitchell O'Connor, famously, start of the doll,
drove down
and the plinth. All the mainly male reporters, hilarity just shows women, particularly because she has a very feminine appearance and all that.
Red
car and all blonde hair. I mean, if you look at the steps, anyone could have done it. They were so invisible and
shallow. They are, yeah. I've been honest. They are, actually. To be fair to you, you're right.
So, however, if you give women a visuospatial task to do, okay, to orient themselves in space and do the visuospatial, yes, they do worse than men. But if you give them the very same task, but describe it as a task of empathy.
Wow, okay. Love this.
And it involves exactly the same cognitive skills. The male-female difference disappears. So
I've got goosebumps now with that. I love that.
The mental computations are the same. But what happens is you tell a woman, this is a it's clear it's a visuospatial task. They know that they're supposed to be poorer in visuospatial abilities. And that thought and the anxiety associated with it interferes with the performance and the task.
Yeah.
And the same thing happens with racial differences in performance and IQ tests, you know, because black people are supposedly poorer, you know, of lower IQ, which it's not a biological reality at all.
There
are cultural and social factors, but their underperformance is hugely reduced. If you don't portray it as an IQ test, if you say this is we're studying thinking, We're studying how people think, and you get them to do exactly the same problems, and they perform much better in it. So, and similarly with older people, if you tell older people, we're giving you a memory test, oh, and by the way, you are in the oldest group of all the people we're... And you know, you find that their memories go way down.
So just fear clogs
the fear and the expectations associated with whatever the negative stereotype is undermines your performance. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So
there's no reason we shouldn't have just as many women engineers.
What a fascinating conversation. I mean, I actually on the list was like, okay, so he's written a book about confidence and he's written another one about stress, and I want to talk about both. We didn't even touch, we did touch on stress, but we didn't even get into it. We don't have time now, so perhaps you might do me the honour of revisiting a conversation down the line, because
delighted.
I would love to talk to you about stress. Final words, your top tips on how to boost your confidence. I mean, I know throughout this conversation you've given them to us, but just a final word for people, if you're struggling with your confidence in your personal life or work life, how can we improve it?
So set goals for yourself that stretch you a little bit, but not too much.
Okay.
So for instance, supposing it's about losing weight, for example, don't set yourself the goal of losing a kilogram or 2 kilograms. Set yourself the goal of changing one item of your diet, you know, at lunchtime a day.
Yeah.
Become skilled at selecting goals that are hard enough that if you succeed them, you'll get a little surge of satisfaction, but that are easy enough that you're probably going to do them okay.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
And build, so success, people who are emotionally successful are very skilled at setting goals for themselves. Even if it's, I'm sitting down at my desk for the next, what's my goal for the next half hour? Okay, my goal is I'm going to finish that horrible report that's been putting off for weeks. I'm just going to do 30 minutes of that. Mm. I won't finish it, but I'm doing 30 minutes on that task that I hate. And by framing the goal like that,
yes,
even if you don't finish the goal, you won't finish it. But having set a goal that's a time goal, and you get a little surge of satisfaction that lifts your mood. So successive goals. Learning to control your anxiety, because anxiety is a great corrosive of confidence. And we can talk about that if I come back.
Yeah.
And your breathing is a huge part of that, and your yes. your mental set is a huge part of that. Just be aware of the saboteurs, the internal and external saboteurs to your confidence, the people in your life for whom it suits for you to be underconfident.
Okay.
and the internal thoughts and words you say to yourself. So that, you know, the
yeah.
And your values, you know, affirm your values to yourself. Who am I? What's and if you affirm your values, even take a minute or two to write down what is it that's at the core of who I am, and why do I hold these values? That's a huge bolster against your ego being weakened, and your sense of confidence being corroded, you know, by say criticism or threat. So affirming your values. So there's a whole lot more. But attention. So Rumi, the Afghanistani Persian poet, said the path only appears with the first step. So you have to,
yes.
Anxiety stops you doing stuff.
Yeah.
You have to keep doing stuff in spite of the anxiety, and trust in it. And yeah. What you know is you don't know what you don't know. Mm. You don't know what you're going to see if you just take that step. And trying to avoid the avoidance that comes with anxiety, and try and set yourself goals. And some of these goals can be internal, like, okay, I'm going to say these things to that person without getting upset. That's my goal.
Mm. Yeah.
And if you're clear in your mind what the goal is and you achieve it, just that goal, that is a huge step towards boosting confidence.
Thank you, Professor Ian Robertson. Your book on confidence is How Confidence Works, The New Science of Self-Belief. And I've already a few things on the list for the next chat. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sheila.
My next episode of Ready to Be Real is with trailblazing entrepreneur Marissa Carter. And if you enjoyed this episode with Professor Ian Robertson, please share it with friends, family, or on social media. And you can support what I do in all the usual ways by clicking follow, giving a rating, or leaving a comment. Thank you so much. You've been listening to Ready to Be Real.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit eBay.com for terms.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.